Ignition sequence start. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. All engine running. Liftoff. We have a liftoff.
Fly me to the moon. Let me play among the stars. Let me see what spring is like on Jupiter and Mars.
Hello and welcome to Season 2, Episode 14 of Space Talks. By now, everyone knows it's a half-hour science-based show with an interest in all things space. I'm Stephen Lowry, along with co-host Tim Woods on Vancouver Island. And today, Tim, tell us of our topic.
You bet, Steve. Now, I'm going to start this week's topic with a quote from Mark Twain, and it's one of my favorites, actually. Here's the quote. "It's not what you don't know that gets you in trouble. It's what you know for sure that just ain't so." Well, not surprisingly, when it comes to figuring out the universe and how it works, a lot of people have been convinced of a lot of stuff that just ain't so. And we're going to get to that today. But first, let's move to our update. Steve, I think you've got a couple for us.
Oh, do I ever. January is proving to be the busy month that we expected for space news, but unfortunately, it's not all been positive. First, here in Canada, there's disappointment that the first return flight with humans to the moon has been pushed back at least 10 months until September 2025. And that, of course, is the Artemis II flight, which will include Canadian astronaut Jeremy Hansen. NASA has detailed three significant problems, and frankly, they didn't seem that confident that the 10-month delay would suffice to get things right. And this is especially disturbing since one of those problems involved, quote, "unexpected performance by the heat shield," and that heat shield is necessary to keep the astronauts alive upon re-entry. Secondly, the United Launch Alliance's powerful new rocket booster, the Vulcan, did successfully launch on a mission to the moon, but after translunar injection, the key payload mission, the Peregrine lander, built by a private company called Astrobiotics, incurred a valve leak of fuel, which unfortunately scuttled the intended landing on the lunar surface. And Tim, I kind of hasten to note that United Launch Alliance is a forced amalgam of Boeing and Lockheed. And they said that this mission was a success in terms of its certification process by the United States Space Force. The Vulcan rocket needs just one more successful launch to get final approval and has made the vague promise that later this year, it will launch its first mission for, quote, "national space security." The lunar timeline pushbacks for Artemis 2 and 3 and the UAL failure, Tim, to me, really underscores Apollo's amazing achievements way back 1969 through the early 1970s.
That is so true, Steve. Now, on our last episode, we were talking about meteors, and there's an update in that regard, too. There was a spectacular fireball, or bolide as they're called, recorded by a New Brunswick homeowner's security cam, and you can see that on YouTube. Now, here's a bit of positive news that came from our updates this week. Just the other day, we learned that 2023 was the hottest year ever, which of course is not good news. However, we've previously talked about some promising technologies that are space-related, might help mitigate the global warming crisis, we'll see. And today's update involves some new research I came across. It's a product that could seriously reduce carbon emissions, and it's called cooling glass. It's a microporous coating that has been shown to reduce the temperature of the material it coats by 3.5 degrees Celsius at noon. And they say it could add up to a 10% reduction in emissions from, say, a mid-sized condo. Now, like some of the fancy new reflective paints that we've previously mentioned, this one also ups the reflective power to, in this case, 99%. But it's the other breakthrough in this product that caught my eye. It induces long-wave infrared radiation, essentially drawing the heat out from the material it's covered and emitting that into space. Is it a product that's going to hit the shelves next week? Nope. However, it's been rigorously tested, comes in four colors, and is expected to have a life expectancy of 30 years. So those are our updates. Now we're going to get back to these misconceptions that we're keen to get to. Now, some of them are a little bit crazy, but they were never really to be taken seriously. In fact, they were more whimsy than theory. And I've got one for you, Steve. The moon is not, in fact, made of green cheese or any other kind of cheese. But as a whimsical fable for children, You know, that's an expression that actually dates back as far as the 16th century in England.
No harm, no foul in that bit of folklore. And it's not like the adults had any better explanations for what made up the lunar surface. And so today's episode is going to delve into some popular misconceptions about space. This is going to be a fun one. Now, if we go back to that same 16th century, it's when another pretty big misconception started to fall out of favor as science came to the rescue. Copernicus actually wasn't the first to challenge the notion that the sun and stars circle the Earth. However, his published research did set us on the right course, away from way back in the 4th century BC when Aristotle championed the incorrect geocentric notion that our wee planet was the center of everything. And by the way, for the record, the Greek philosopher Aristarchus of Samos did propose the correct heliocentric version way early in the 3rd century BC, but he lost favor.
Now, I only paid a small amount of attention to those Greek philosophers in, you know, my university days, but in today's pop culture, Aristotle is really not much more than a statuette, and actually not a memorable one at that. The name's familiar to people, but little else. So, did Aristotle get more right than wrong? Steve, when it comes to the sun and the Earth orbits, he was just making stuff up. And he wasn't the only one. You have to keep in mind that people were asking questions and an assertively stated answer, well, better than no answer at all. Here's another couple of guesses made based on nothing more than what the eye could see. Way back in the early 17th century, Galileo used a primitive telescope to observe what he called ears on Saturn. And it wasn't that much later that the Dutch astronomer Christian Huygens had a slightly better telescope, and that allowed him to identify the rings of Saturn. Now, you have to fast forward all the way to 1977 when we discovered that there were indeed rings around Uranus. And then 1979, the phenomenon was also discovered for Jupiter. And then again in 1984, when the rings of Neptune were seen.
And it remains today that a goodly number of people think that Saturn is our only ring planet. While it's true that most of the more well-known misconceptions were driven by ignorance of facts, not all misconceptions are such. Some are urban myths. Now, here's one such example. For quite some time, NASA has been accused of unnecessarily wasting taxpayers' money, and it certainly has had its share of bad luck and choices, Tim. However, a prime example is the notion that NASA spent millions of taxpayer dollars in developing a ballpoint pen which could function in zero gravity. And by the way, the term zero gravity is another misconception which we'll get to later this episode. By contrast, the more frugal and wiser Russian cosmonaut said nyet to that and employed the good old-fashioned pencil for writing in space. So let's clear up that misconception once and for all. In the 1960s, both the U.S. and Russian space programs realized that pens, which of course rely on gravity to make the ink flow, would be useless in space. Now, contrary to popular belief, the astronauts on the Mercury and Gemini flights did use pencils, just like the Russians, but there was a hazard in doing so. First of all, let's clear up the misconception that pencils contain lead. They don't. Pencils contain graphite, which is a good conductor of electricity, and broken bits floating around the inside of a spacecraft is an electrical hazard, as they can embed themselves in switches and dials and create short circuits. And an aside here, Tim, I had my science students conduct experiments by scribbling thick dark pencil lines on paper and applying voltages to them to complete circuits.
Well, apparently, since pencils are a no-go for space work, how did the space pen come about then?
Well, first, Tim, we should notify listeners that the phrase space pen has become trademarked, and for good reason. Businessman and inventor Paul Fisher had founded a company to produce ballpoint pens prior to the space race. In 1966, and a million research dollars later, he invented and patented a ballpoint cartridge that would write in any position thanks to using a special ink cartridge pressurized with nitrogen gas. He then pitched that pen to NASA, which, after the fatal fire of Apollo 1, banned all spacecraft combustibles. And so, beginning with the October 1968 Apollo 7 mission, the Fisher AG-7 astronaut space pen trademark was used, and yes, it will be going on the upcoming Artemis 2 missions and future Mars missions. But you know, Tim, that's not the best part. You can buy the AG7 Space Pen today by simply going to their website at www.spacepen.ca. And as our dear old friend Ron Popeil used to say, but wait, there's more. You can buy a wide variety of space pens at various price points from their site.
Well, I can't wait. But okay, so we've cleared up that misconception, but here's another one that's very much popular today. And let's see where that shakes out. There's a widespread belief that black holes, which are often in the news, suck up everything around them like some kind of cosmic vacuum cleaner. Sagittarius A star is the name of the black hole at the center of our Milky Way. But should we be worried? Well, I'm going to say no, Steve, but don't listen to me. Try out this answer from the lecture series Misconceptions in Space, which I found on YouTube. Let's have a listen.
We are going to talk about the idea, the incorrect idea, that black holes behave like cosmic vacuum cleaners sucking up anything near them. No, they are not. A black hole is a very compact mass in space, so it's a lot of material compressed into a very small amount of space. But the extreme relativistic effects of a black hole are only noted close to the black hole, so only when you get close to the black hole. We have what we call the event horizon here. Within that, no light can escape, and we cannot know anything about what goes on inside. Outside of that, things can escape. Light can escape from outside that event horizon. Now, if you get close to the event horizon, very strange things will happen. You don't want to get too close to an event horizon, but the event horizon is very small. For something like our sun, if our sun were compressed to a black hole, it might be only a kilometer or so in size. So it would be very small, and as long as you stayed far enough away from that, you could orbit around just as we do.
So there you go, Steve. Our galaxy's black hole is causing the stars to orbit around it, not swallowing them up.
Excellent news about black holes, Tim. However, as a youngster, I recall watching lots of science fiction movies and TV shows fraught with another danger. Deadly asteroids between Mars and Jupiter. Isn't there danger in navigating through a field of asteroids as depicted in movies such as Armageddon or the Star Trek TV series? Surely there's got to be some truth to that, Tim. I mean, Hollywood wouldn't lie to us, would it?
Well, not so fast, Steve. On the one hand, the total number of asteroids that are, say, a kilometer in diameter or larger between Mars and Jupiter, it adds up to millions. But they're not all crowded together. That's the thing. They're not all hanging out in one little neighborhood. For example, in 2007, NASA launched the Dawn space probe to enter the asteroid belt, explore two specific asteroids, and it did so without incident. And you know why? It's because these asteroids are typically millions of kilometers apart. Now, to illustrate this point, as we like to do here on Space Talks, imagine placing hundreds of bowling lanes side by side and standing a single pin in the middle. Now, your task is to bowl a ball and hit the pin representing an asteroid. Now, Steve, I've seen you bowl, and dare I tell folks, I've seen you miss all five pins using three tries when they're all lined up in just one lane.
Tim, that's a lie, a total lie. And besides, I wasn't trying. I have astigmatism. I had a cold. I could go on.
I don't know if I believe that, Steve. Now, there you have it. If you ever find yourself piloting a spaceship outbound from Mars, you'd have to be trying pretty hard to hit one of those millions of asteroids orbiting our sun between Mars and Jupiter.
So, you know, Tim, speaking of piloting a spaceship, I just so happen to have a little something from 1950 regarding that very thing. It's a clip from the Tom Corbett Space Cadet TV series, imagining a scenario 400 years in the future in the year 2350. So put on your helmets and let's have a brief listen, and you'll see how captivating this type of media was to children.
Kellogg, the greatest name in cereals, presents Tom Corbett, Space Cadet.
In a desperate race against time and death, the rocket cruiser Polaris arrows through the blackness of space in pursuit of a runaway asteroid, a gigantic mass of radioactive rock which threatens the destruction of the planet Earth.
What's this Alfie's been telling me about your losing sight of this asteroid?
See for yourself, sir. I can't find it anywhere.
But, Astro, that's impossible. An asteroid can't just disappear.
I know, Alfie, I know, but where is it?
Now, listen, when did this happen? When did you first lose track of it?
When you were outside with Tom and Manning.
A thing like this simply doesn't happen.
Sir, if I may offer a possible solution.
Yes, sir.
Well, the asteroid was traveling at a tremendous rate of speed when we last observed it. Could it possibly have burned itself up?
Now, you know better than that, Higgins. The asteroid was traveling through space. It would have to have an atmosphere to create that kind of friction.
Oh, of course. How stupid of me.
Wait a minute. There's Mars. If the asteroid passed through the atmosphere of Mars,
No, it couldn't have, Astro. Not according to our calculations. It orbits cleared Mars by at least 300,000 miles.
Great Jupiter, that's it.
What do you mean?
That's it. How thick can we be? Mars. Mars is our answer. Astro, change the setting on that scanner. Take it up to 5. There we are.
Why, the craters of Luna, the asteroid.
Of course. It was almost an eclipse behind Mars.
No wonder.
Now we're going to have one sweet time trying to catch it.
So just before station break, let's talk about the misconception of there being zero G in space, especially while orbiting the Earth in the ISS, the International Space Station, or the Chinese equivalent. So yes, the astronauts and taikonauts seemingly float, but it's not because there's zero gravity. In fact, they are under the influence of 90% of Earth's gravity. They float because they're falling, just as you would if you fell off the top of your roof. Now, while falling, you'd be weightless, even though you'd still be in Earth's gravity. The astronauts don't fall to Earth because they're speeding in a fashion which negates them hitting. Instead of using the term zero G, they now use the term micro G. Though, personally, I'd consider 90% of something to be more than micro.
I totally agree, Tim, and I'm sure our listeners need a moment or two to consider these misconceptions and perhaps think of a couple of their own. We're back and talking about misconceptions about space, and Tim, I believe you've got a couple about our sun, and the first one's a doozy.
Sure is. Now, given the life-giving role that our sun plays, you'd think that we'd know a little bit more about it than we do. Doesn't get much attention. It's pretty much taken for granted. Now, for one thing, you can't actually look at the sun without wearing protective lenses, or its ultraviolet radiation will literally sunburn your cornea, so people don't pay a great deal of attention. It's ubiquitous, it's constant, and as we say, it rises in the east every morning and sets in the west. Well, actually, it doesn't. It's the Earth's rotation that makes it seem that way. But here's a couple of basic questions for you, Steve, about our sun, which many people would struggle with. What color is the sun, and how does it work?
Well, you know, Tim, my typical off-the-cuff answer would be, the sun is yellow, and it's burning to produce heat and light.
And you, sir, would be wrong. It's kind of funny when you think about it. Our sun is just one of billions of stars in our galaxy, and for the most part, we look up at the sky, and we see almost nothing but white stars, and as the poets like to say, twinkling stars. And we tend to imagine, though, that our sun is a burning yellow globe, but that's in fact not the case. It's our atmosphere which scatters the sunlight, if you will, filters it, and this is especially evident at dawn and dusk, giving it a more yellow or even orange hue. However, if you're on the moon's surface or in space, our sun is a brilliant white star and not yellow. Now, about how it works to produce heat and light. It's not a chemical reaction like burning a can of Sterno when you'd go camping back in the day. Instead, our sun and all stars produce heat and light through nuclear fusion. Now, let's have a brief listen to why the sun couldn't possibly be burning and what it actually does.
To a scientist living in the 18th century, the most likely analogy of how the sun worked might have been to compare it to a log in a fireplace. When something like wood burns, there is a reaction between it and oxygen in the air that creates energy in the form of heat and light. Could some kind of burning be the mechanism of the sun's light? And if you take the number of atoms and figure out how long it would continue to produce this amount of energy, you can calculate this number to be about 20,000 years. This, of course, can't be the mechanism of the sun because at this rate, it would have burned out a long time ago. We know from radioactive dating of meteorites, which are part of the leftover remnants of the sun's original formation, that the sun is about 4.5 billion years old. So what causes the sun to shine at such high energies for so long? Where does this energy come from? But the sun doesn't convert all its energy to mass. In fact, it converts only about 0.7% of its mass to energy in a process called fusion. This is where four hydrogen atoms fuse to form one helium atom. And using this process, the sun will last approximately 10 billion years.
Well, that rather explains that the sun doesn't burn. It transmutes, or fuses, if you will, four hydrogen atoms into one helium atom and releases all kinds of electromagnetic radiation, some of it being in the form of heat and light. Now, we're not going to get into the details of nuclear fusion here, but let's tackle the misconception that stars twinkle.
Now, this one is a whole lot easier than trying to understand nuclear fusion, Steve. Stars appear to twinkle for the simple reason that their steady light is refracted as it passes through our atmosphere, and that's what makes it appear to twinkle. Various temperature layers in our atmosphere also account for the shimmering effect seen over hot items such as road surfaces, or if you look closely, the air right above your toaster when it's converting bread to toast. And no, that's not nuclear fusion. By the way, the reason the planets such as Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn don't twinkle is that they are close enough to us to appear as circles, not merely points, as our faraway stars do.
Thank you. That's another misconception checked off. Now, how about this one, which I admit is rather moot, and it's that the planets revolve around the sun. Now, we've already established the heliocentric or sun-centered solar system is correct. So how can us revolving around the sun be a misconception?
Actually, this is a kind of picky one, Steve. We can give a pass, though, to all our teachers who unwittingly let that phrase pass their lips. With regard to any two objects, there is a point between them where their masses balance, which is called the barycenter. Between the Earth and the Moon, the barycenter is not the midway point between the two, but is actually about 1,300 kilometers deep inside the Earth's crust.
Oh, wait a minute. That's kind of confusing. So I guess this means that unlike the common, if you will, God's eye view of the Earth being stationary and the Moon going around it in an elliptical path, in reality, both the Earth and the Moon are moving around in a wobbly path around a barycenter.
And this is, of course, true for the Sun and the other planets. So it's proper to say the Sun and planets revolve around a gravitational center, which is inside the Sun. Now, I wanted to point out, Steve, that the Sun is 99.86% of the entire mass of the solar system, including all the planets. So a God's eye view would indeed show the planets revolving around the sun, but a closer examination would show that the sun itself is wobbling around a hidden center.
Well, Tim, keen listeners can learn more about this by researching the, quote, two-body problem and looking for some explanatory animations on YouTube.
Hey, Steve, there's another misconception that we're going to tackle, and that is that nothing can go faster than the speed of light, which is about 300,000 kilometers per second. And rather like the barycenter concept, this one too has a proviso. Travel at speeds greater than the speed of light occurs only in science fiction, but traveling faster than light has happened in the universe's history.
Wait a minute. No object with mass can reach the speed of light, but you say that somehow this has happened? How can that be?
As we mentioned in a previous episode, there was a rapid expansion of the universe after the Big Bang, and it had the universe create itself faster than the speed of light. Now, Einstein's theory of relativity states that nothing in space can move faster than the speed of light, but it doesn't mean that space itself can't expand faster than light, and it has, and it does. However, we also know that galaxies are moving away from each other at great speed, and in a relative way, what that means is that there is the appearance of objects moving away from us at speeds greater than the speed of light. And this phenomenon has a great name. It's called superluminal recession. And it's important to note that this does not violate the principles of special relativity. The restriction on the speed of light applies, but the expansion of space itself can cause distant objects to appear to recede from each other at rates that exceed the speed of light. So, translation, if you check the fine print, things might appear to be going faster than light speed, but it's an optical illusion.
Well, this is another concept which I'll have to revisit time and time again, getting a better idea each time. But let's wrap up with a few somewhat easier to manage misconceptions. Now, The Dark Side of the Moon is a great album, but is there such a thing as the dark side of the moon, or did Pink Floyd just make all that stuff up?
Just like Aristotle, they made it up, so no. Now, it's easy to see why you could think that. The moon's weight is not perfectly distributed. You might say there's a fat side of the moon, not a dark side. And that heavier side of the moon is always facing us. And that's a function of gravity, where the center of the moon's mass is located.
So the far side of the moon does in fact experience light and dark, just as we do. But the moon's day is 29 days long, as is its night.
Now, going back to the movie Armageddon, or that Tom Corbett clip, could a nuclear weapon be used to blow up a dangerous asteroid, or is Hollywood again allowing the likes of Bruce Willis to merely entertain us?
No, don't blow up an asteroid. It's safer to nudge it off course. On previous episodes, we've mentioned actual efforts being made to alter the course of asteroids. Though NASA's DART mission to the Didymos asteroid did nudge it by impacting, this is not the ideal because it creates a debris field of meteoroids. And imagine the size of that field should a nuclear weapon be used. Now, the European Space Agency, or ESA, is set to launch the HERA, H-E-R-A, space probe in October of this year to study Didymos to contribute to the validation of that kinetic impact method and also analyze the expanding debris cloud caused by that impact. In absolute terms, it's best to divert the intact asteroid, but currently that technology is beyond us. You know, Tim, my dad used to have a plaque on the wall in our house which read, "You can sleep safely tonight because your Air Force is on guard."
Well, good news. On planet Earth, we can be equally reassured because there are, in fact, are agencies such as NASA's ATLAS, which stands for Asteroid Terrestrial Impact Last Alert System, and that's on guard for us. Additionally, there exists the LAWN project, and that stands for International Asteroid Warning Network, and the Planetary Defense Coordination Office. So, score one for us, Steve. Planet Earth, we're doing what we need to. The dinosaurs are saying it's a little too late. And you know what, Steve? It's too late to explore any more of the many misconceptions that we have about our universe. And that's all the time we have for this episode of Space Talks. This is Tim Woods.
And Stephen Lowry saying so long, and we'll see you next time on
Space Talks.
You know, Tom, Captain Strong is a very brave man to do a thing like this.
Brave isn't the word for it, Alfie. He's got about one chance in 1,000 of getting through alive.
All right, it's all set up. I've rigged up a set of manual controls on the torpedo.
Right.
Is the Polaris in position for firing?
As close as we can get her into line, Alfie.
Boy, what a crazy idea, riding a torpedo to guide it to its target.
But he's...
He's committing suicide.
But he's also saving Earth, Roger.
How about it? You put a full charge in the warhead?
Enough titanium to blow that asteroid into space dust.
Good. And what about manual controls?
Astro's down there making final adjustments now.
All right, now listen carefully, boys. Here are your orders. When the torpedo leaves the ship, you will change orbit. Dr. Dale has the new readings. You will hold that orbit for 6 hours, and then you will take a tight orbit looking for me. I will ride the torpedo until I'm close enough to ensure a hit, and then I'll leave it. You'll have to fish me out of space.
But, sir, won't your inertia carry you along with the torpedo?
I have just 10 hours' supply of oxygen. If you don't get me in that time, well, return to Earth.
Fly me to the moon. Let me play among the stars. Let me see what spring brings.